Welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Matt Hoffman, Managing Editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we've got Dr. Chris Winter, the owner of Charlottesville Neurology and Sleep Medicine Clinic and CNSM Consulting, and an author of several books on sleep. He joined the show to share his perspective on the state of pediatric sleep disorders, how the current system of schooling affects children's sleep, and the trends that are occurring in sleep research. Let's dive in.
Hi, my name is Chris Winter. I'm a neurologist and sleep specialist in Charlottesville, Virginia. Author of The Sleep Solution, Why Your Sleep's Broken and How to Fix It, as well as The Rested Child, Why Your Tired, Wired, or Irritable Child May Have a Sleep Disorder and How to Help. Also host of the Sleep Unplugged podcast. Dr. Chris Winter, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. If you dare, go there. So there's kind of two different things going on in that conversation. There's sort of the what do we know, and then there's sort of the what can we do. And those tend to be two different conversations. The what we know is that for the most part, young people, in terms of their chronotype or their sort of circadian timing, tend to do better on a later schedule. And anybody who's a parent of, you know, preteens or teens kind of get that, that they like to stay up late and sleep in late. You know, doesn't mean there can't be children who have that more sort of advanced circadian rhythm where they want to get up early and go to bed early, but that's not typically the norm. So when you look at the academic peak of most young people that are in, you know, middle school or high school, it's probably happening around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. My kids are out of school. We're out of school at that time. So there's always been a push to, or should we try to move that school day a little closer to when that peak is happening? And it's not just academics that has, you know, a peak and a trough time. You know, Jürgen Aschoff said famously that everything that a body does has a maximum and a minimum, and academic performance is no different. So it's really just about trying to align the school day with when those things might be happening for the average child. I always look at a graduation and think, is that really the valedictorian, or is that just the kid that was most aligned with that sleep schedule? So the counter argument's always been, okay, yeah, we get that. But in terms of busing and sort of logistics, it becomes extremely difficult, not only from the school perspective, but how many parents want to hang around until 10 o'clock and drop their kids off and then go to work. They've got to be to work. So, you know, there's a whole childcare issue that's always gone along with this. And then the overwhelming contrary argument has always been, well, if you let them stay up later, they'll just sleep later. You know, if you let them sleep later, they'll just stay up later. They won't actually utilize that time. And so what's interesting about COVID is we've just done the experiment. What happens if you eliminate preschool activities like your kid who swims? I've got a swimmer in my house, also got a rower in my house. That was gone immediately. And they really didn't have to roll out of bed and do anything until about 9:30 was when their first classes started. So is that true? Will they just get up at 9:30 and push their bedtime back? And what studies have shown and will continue to probably show that are coming out of COVID is that no, that kids actually tended to utilize that time to sleep more. So I think that we've got to sort of look at the two different things. What can we do logistically to support kids? But also, is there biology and science to align itself with the idea that kids will be healthier, happier, perform better, shoot more free throws, you know, successfully, if we can align those things? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about it from a logistic perspective, as you said. And then, of course, obviously, things vary state to state in the U.S., at least. So I'm curious, you know, it's interesting you brought up COVID because that has been kind of a discussion, especially around schooling. You know, how did these changes affect kids? And I do wonder, you know, now that we're talking about it, is perhaps a shift to a somewhat virtual model, is that how you potentially overcome some of these, you know, logistic nightmares or obstacles rather, of having to then deal with the change in busing schedules and the fact that, you know, people have set work schedules that align with these school start times, so on and so forth?
Yeah, I think we have to be a little careful with that. If it's one thing that I've learned from dealing with, I work a lot with professional athletes and their sleep and their travel. And while you might look at a situation and say, it is absolutely in your team's best interest to leave immediately after this game and travel wherever you're going to get ready for the next one, the sleep piece becomes one metric in a whole algorithm of, yeah, but the team really wants to stay over in LA and go out that night. And so if you deny them that, they're going to be so upset about that situation that that might impact their. So when you're looking at the virtual, you know, I'm certainly not making an argument that virtual school, which allows kids to sleep in a little bit later, is somehow superior to in person. You might be getting a little bit of a circadian benefit, but a dramatic loss of that in-person connection benefit or the social isolation of virtual school. So I think that if you can support all the other variables, sure. And I think that that changes from student to student, you know, looking at ways we could support that ability to push things a little bit later, because like you said, the logistics does become a problem, but if it becomes apples to oranges, it's harder to make that comparison versus we're keeping everything the same. We're just going to start our school district 45 minutes later or an hour later versus an hour earlier. I think that's an easier comparison to make.
Yeah, probably because it changes. It doesn't change the model as much.
Correct. And you know, I think that with all the research that's coming out of the COVID situation about the timing of schools and what that did for kids, I'm sure there's equal educational research about what does that lack of in-person connection, socialization mean? And you know, I just ran into a college professor and he said, it's definitely created a decline in the caliber of students that I'm seeing in the college classroom. So That is a really tangled question to answer, because I think for every benefit of virtual learning, there are probably several drawbacks, particularly with a younger group, but probably with older kids as well too.
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, when you talk about the difference between then, you know, the impact or the benefit potentially for, say, a kid in high school versus someone even younger than that. And I'm curious, you know, a lot of the conversations that we have with sleep medicine specialists, eventually a lot of the framework for solving some of these challenges is really education about the importance of sleep at a younger age. And obviously that's the sleep education conversation as a whole is kind of really ramped up in the last few years, especially in the public sector versus the, you know, the medical professional sector. But for you, I mean, what's the challenge there? Because obviously education on a wide scale, there's a lot of gears that need to be turned in order to get things moving. You know, is there enough education on sleep in perhaps in school, or whether it's just sort of from the medical community to the lay public about, you know, we really need to ingrain these behaviors and the importance of getting the correct amount of sleep as you grow, and particularly, you know, establishing it as a, again, a set of behaviors that you'll continue into adulthood?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think the answer is no. And it's strange because my guess is if you surveyed 100 parents or 100 students and asked them how important is sleep, they would say it's really important. So there is definitely a disconnect between what we think and say and maybe believe and what we actually do. I mean, I wrote in my most recent book, The Rested Child, the two biggest threats to a kid's sleep, I think, are technology and school. So in looking at that, it becomes a very difficult thing to sort of unravel. A school saying to a parent, listen, if your kid has too much homework or is on a travel soccer game, just let them know that they can, you know, do as much homework as they can, but make sure they get their sleep. Well, great, until they get homework the next night and still have the night. It just becomes this sort of grinding situation that more and more parents are telling me about the fact that their kid is playing one sport. They're not playing three sports. They're not overscheduled. But the homework and out of class demands on them are just crushing and very difficult for them to not only sort of expect and understand, but also predict as they relate to their other classes. So I think there's a tremendous gap in knowledge, both with schools, also with parents. I mean, I think parents want to do the right thing, but there's not great resources about sleep out there. It's sort of like there's a lot of books about how to get your baby to sleep through the night. But once you've got that set up and they're taking a good nap, it's kind of like the message is you're free and clear, and you're very much not. And then the other thing we have to deal with is looking at ourselves within our own medical community. How much sleep training has your child's doctor gotten in their entire career? The answer very could well be zero. So when we're taking our children to medical professionals and saying, look, I think there might be a problem, what are we getting in return besides a melatonin gummy bear? Often that, in fact, a residency director, I will not name the school, told me if melatonin gummy bears disappeared one day, our residents have no ability to treat a child's sleep problem. So I think there's a lot of things going on there that sort of sum to be the situation where I don't think there's any disorder within children that can hide better than a sleep disorder, particularly since we live in a culture where if you went to somebody and said, man, my kid's awfully tired, you'd be like, yeah, we're all tired. Let's move on. Like, everybody's tired. You know, that's part of being. And even my daughter one time said something to me about, I think people need to learn how to deal with sleep deprivation better. I'm like, why would you say that? And she said, well, they're going to go to college and you got to learn it. You either learn it in high school or you learn it in college. But at some point, it just becomes and I won't even get into my middle son who's at the Naval Academy. Like, I do not understand how that algorithm works. So, you know, that, or if you're an NCAA athlete, I had a coach tell me one time that their athletes have 27 hours of commitment, have to be at every class. I mean, it was just when you added up all their hours that they needed to account for, it was more than exist in the week. So I think there's a tremendous gap between what we say, the lip service we pay sleep, and what we actually do for people.
Yeah, it almost becomes a from a behavioral health standpoint, this need to really, you know, back up the words that, yes, that are, because again, yeah, you're correct. It does seem like it is something. I have that sort of same reaction every time we have, you know, a major push. And when we talk to the ASM, you know, there's this understanding from the general population that sleep is super important and it touches everything. And we're really seeing the science advance to prove that in the last decade or so. But yeah, there just seems to be this miscommunication or something's getting lost in translation.
Sure. It's a failed reward system. I mean, look at your kids when they're in the middle of their high school exam season or midterms. Are you really rewarding the smartest child, or are you rewarding the kid that can pull the all-nighters and cram the most because they've got four tests and two papers in 6 days? You know, so we say one thing, but I think that the kid up there with the extra stoles and everything making the valedictorian speech might be the kid who manages sleep deprivation the best. Is that something we necessarily want to reward and praise?
Yeah, and it's interesting. You said earlier, you know, obviously there's this challenge because pediatric sleep disorders do exist, but they can be very difficult to identify. And again, you know, when we're talking about whether it's a primary care physician or even a community neurologist, sometimes we're talking about this is the first patient they've seen with this condition that they're aware of. You know, they got very little training in medical school or in their residency.
Yeah, so absolutely.
For you, I mean, what's kind of our understanding of the prevalence of some of these disorders among the pediatric population? You know, how can the physician community kind of be a little more aware of these things and on the lookout for them when they happen to interact with these patients? Or, you know, like you said, a parent brings up, I think there might be an issue related to sleep here.
I think when you look at sleep disorders as a whole, the prevalence is huge, especially when you compare it to things like depression, diabetes, other things that we think about as existing primary, you know, in the pediatric population, mood disturbances, depression, anxiety, attention problems often masquerade, their sleep problems masquerading as those types of things. You know, I think the biggest issue we tend to have to some degree is if you sort of split sleep disorders in half, the kids who cannot sleep, struggle with sleep, can't fall asleep, wake up, can't get back to sleep. And then the kids who are excessively sleepy. They come home, they take a 3-hour nap. When they were little, they never fussed about naps. They put themselves to bed, sleep, sleep, sleep. I mean, what parent wouldn't want that child? Isn't that what you're praying for as the baby's coming out of the birth canal? Oh God, please let him be a great sleeper. So it's interesting that we've got, we just looked at 483 media articles about sleep. And one of them had something to do with narcolepsy and excessive sleepiness. So when we exclusively focus on what are some 7 tips to get my kid to fall asleep at night and how can I get my kid to sleep and what happens if he can't fall asleep and can't fall asleep and melatonin, blah, blah, blah. When that becomes the media focus, we completely lose sight of the children who are falling asleep in class. And in a weird way, they become great sleepers. Oh, my kid's such a good sleeper. He can fall asleep in class. That's not a good sleeper. That is a kid who's so deprived in terms of their sleep that they're struggling. So if we can get a little bit less of the focus on the kids who are struggling to sleep and more of a spotlight or at least a radar within that pediatric clinic of the kids who are coming who spend entire weekends in their bed, come home from, they've dropped travel soccer because they just want to sleep, they're nodding off in school, and let that ring the same kind of alarms that the insomnia complaints are ringing, I think we'll pick up on a lot more of them.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Dr. Winter to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, recent reports indicate that 2 children with spinal muscular atrophy in Russia and Kazakhstan who were administered the gene therapy Zolgensma have died because of acute liver injury. The deaths occurred at some point in the past few months, at an estimated 5 to 6 weeks post-infusion of the treatment, and between 1 to 10 days post-tapering of corticosteroids. Novartis, the company that develops the drug, has notified the physicians and payers about the deaths and notified, in a statement issued to Neurology Live, that it plans to update the therapy's label to include information on these events. Next, Passage Bio has dosed the first patient with frontotemporal dementia with granulin mutations with its gene therapy PBFT02 in the phase 1-2 UPLIFT-D study. The investigational therapy uses an AAV1 delivery model to introduce a functional copy of the GRN gene to patients with FTD, which encodes progranulin, and a deficiency in this encoding is believed to contribute to lysosomal dysfunction. Previously, the gene therapy was granted an orphan drug designation by the FDA for the treatment of this patient population, and in January 2021, the agency accepted an investigational new drug application. Next, in a recent company update, Brainstorm Cell Therapeutics announced a new clinical analyses that have now strengthened the phase 3 findings of its NeurOwn technology platform for patients with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. An erratum published in Muscle and Nerve has now prompted the company to plan for a submission of a biologics license application for the therapeutic, a decision that comes more than a year after the FDA recommended against. Finally, Jazz Pharmaceuticals has announced that it will evaluate cannabidiol, known as Epidiolex, in a phase 3 trial for children and adolescents with epilepsy who experience myoclonic atonic seizures. The pivotal study is a 2-part randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial that will enroll approximately 240 children and adolescents aged 1 to 18 years. Part A of the study will assess the efficacy and tolerability of CBD compared with placebo as an adjunctive treatment, while Part B will evaluate the long-term safety and tolerability of the medication. For more information about these stories, you can head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding links in the show notes. And now, back to Dr. Winter.
It is interesting because you do think, you know, in the adult population, I don't have the statistics to back this up, but it does feel like the conversations are almost 50-50 in terms of the insomnia versus the narcolepsy. But when we get into the pediatrics, it is very much, focused. Yeah. That is an interesting. I'm curious, do you think What has to happen to change that? Is it just a level of awareness about these things, or is it, you know, like we were saying earlier, sort of more access or more exposure to education around these things when we're bringing up, you know, potential primary care physicians or even perhaps pediatric specialists, you know, the medical education system?
I think it's both. I mean, when I've sat around and talked to other sleep doctors, you know, we all have this dream. Give me a 1.5 hour lecture in front of the entire body of pediatrics out there, or the entire body of primary care. I think that within a very short period of time, we could plant the seeds and alter some evaluation behaviors that would really help us explore these types of things. For instance, you're going to diagnose a child with ADHD or ADD. That's fine. Have you considered just a sleep evaluation, not even a sleep study, you know, before you make that determination? Because I can promise you this, if a kid's excessively sleepy, he will look like he has an attention problem. So then it just becomes, we're not going to radically change the way this doctor is approaching her patient. It's just really more about adding something to a differential or a process that was never added when you were in your residency training. I mean, again, I got 1 hour lecture of sleep when I was in medical school. I was a neurology resident. We didn't really have a sleep faculty member on our staff at the University of Virginia. I was just working in another person's sleep lab all along since undergrad. So I knew a lot about sleep, but that was not the norm. So it just really becomes, and you can see it when you've got good sleep services in a community, because as we start to diagnose and feed back to that pediatrician, that primary care doctor, all of a sudden we start getting more referrals saying, you know, rule out narcolepsy, rule out restless leg, even if it's not right. We're so excited because that primary care doctor, instead of jumping right to whatever, thought, well, maybe we should send this person over to a sleep specialist because maybe there is something going on here. The other group that's really embraced sleep, I feel like over the last 5 years, is the psychiatric community. This idea that we've tried 7 different drugs for this individual, this kid can't really get their depression under better control. Is it really depression, or is it actually excessive sleepiness and fatigue? And I think that we're about to get a tidal wave of post-COVID, long COVID people that are kind of sweeping through our population of fatigue and excessive sleepiness. So I think we need to kind of be prepared for these types of things and really have a plan for, are you even asking about sleepiness in your patient population? We know from survey research, both in adults and kids, most doctors don't. And I don't fault them. They don't have time. You got 7 minutes to see your patient so you can keep the lights on in your clinic. The last thing you want to do is, hey, how are you sleeping? Because that is a 30-minute conversation, but I think it's one that has to happen.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that so many of these, not smaller, but kind of ongoing challenges that are all happening at once, a lot of them do boil down to the difficulty of that lack of time to have the discussion, unfortunately. I'm curious too, you know, you think as sort of medicine has kind of trended in this multi-specialty, you know, more holistic view, I wonder, because, you know, speaking to the holistic approach to patient care, I really do think sleep is kind of the ultimate example of holistic medicine because of its ability to sort of touch all these and affect all these different aspects. I mean, how many chronic diseases fatigue is a major symptom of, and how much of that could potentially be at least benefited a little bit from looking at sleep. And I wonder too, you know, I know you mentioned obviously just surveying patients about sleep can help. Where do you think we're at with the sort of ability to do sleep studies on individuals? Because obviously I know that's a challenge with, you know, identifying a person's true sleep, since you have to bring them into a lab. They're not in the environment they're used to. I know that's kind of a double compound question there, but I'm curious, you know, where you sort of see things going in the next few years.
Well, I think you bring up 2 good points. The idea that sleep touches so many different disorders is a huge one. I mean, what does a patient really have dominion over? Nutrition, exercise, mindfulness, and sleep. That's really it. I mean, when we work with a patient, a client, an athlete, that's what you have under your control. My father was a football coach. He'd always look at me as a relatively short man and say, you can't coach big. And what he meant by that was, I can make you faster, learn more about whatever sport you are. I'm never going to make you a 6'4", 250-pound giant. You know, like, I can't do that. So let's control what we can control. And I think sleep is one of those things that's very much not only under our control, but when you optimize it, it just affects everything. It's like that entire web of disease, blood pressure, weight, mood, attention, whatever, you name it. It's probably one or two jumps away from sleep. So I think that's really important. In terms of sleep studies and sleep analysis, I think we're in a great time right now. I think COVID hastened a lot of technology advances. We do a lot more telehealth, so we can reach more people than ever. There are a lot of individuals now who see a doctor virtually, have a home sleep study, and then get put up on an automatic CPAP, an APAP device, and have never even walked or stepped foot into a sleep lab, which is awesome to me. And then when you look at the consumer end of technology for sleep, there is a massive collision that's getting ready to happen. In the past, it's always been, yeah, you can wear that cute little watch, but it is not equal what's going on in our official university, sleep center. And I think that the lay person's access to good information about their sleep is starting to get close to that point where it's rivaling it. I'm sure in 10 years, it'll surpass it. So what happens now when the lay person has great access to information about their own sleep without that guiding doctor? And so these are all very interesting questions, but I'm very enthusiastic for the layperson saying, I'm not waiting around for this thing to happen or my doctor to refer me. More and more patients are coming to me with really interesting information about their sleep, their pulse ox at night, their movements, et cetera. And that really only increases the visibility of sleep and our ability to kind of get people in front of us so we can help them.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, if we can get the sort of physician asking and inquiring about it, if we can get that worked into the process, that's one arm of that. But then, yeah, increasing that public interest in being, conscious about their sleep. Obviously, that goes back to the, putting actions to the words we're saying, conversation from earlier.
Absolutely. And sleep has a certain panache and sexiness. People love to talk about sleep. I joke, I always feel bad about the spleen specialist. And she's sitting around thinking, how can I get the spleen on the cover of Time magazine or Newsweek? No, you can't, because nobody cares about the spleen, even though it's super important. But sleep, man, we got sleep and brain health. All those things are really exciting and fun topics. So we can really capitalize on that public enthusiasm for the topic. We just need to match the enthusiasm with good information that's going out there to them. Actionable information.
Absolutely. Really, obviously, a lot going on. It seems like, again, that sleep's in a very good place and that we're headed in the right direction. So, any closing thoughts or anything else, again, tips for the community about how to kind of keep that conversation going?
Yeah, I think that, I feel like I'm reaching, if I haven't already gotten there, halfway through my career. I started in sleep back in 92 as an undergrad. I'm, approaching 50. And I've just kind of been waiting around for the medical community to just embrace sleep and go after it. And I've come to the conclusion that that might be a little bit slower than I've got time to wait for. So I really feel like if you're a patient, that you just need to advocate for yourself. If you're a parent, you advocate for your child and you say, hey, look, before you put them on that medication for depression or anxiety or attention or whatever it is, could we talk to a sleep specialist and just have a referral? And if the answer is no, get another doctor, because that's something, why would you ever say no to that? I mean, the worst case scenario is you go see the sleep doctor and like, yeah, your sleep's fine. I don't think that's the reason why you're struggling to attend to these math problems or whatever. Or like the patient I just saw an hour ago, you put her in an environment, she was falling asleep in an average of about 2 minutes, anytime, day or night. If you turn your back on her, 120 seconds later, she's asleep. That individual is going to struggle mightily at school. But thank goodness she had an amazing school nurse who looked at that, contacted the parents and said, your child's falling asleep, but I think it's because there's something wrong, not because your kid is lazy, not because she doesn't care about school, not because of video games at night or whatever the case may be. I think there's a disorder. And sure enough, there very much was. So I think that those kinds of dialogues, which existed completely outside of the medical community until it got to that level, are really what needs to happen. We need to understand more about sleep pathology so we can recognize it.
thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.